Bret Hart Radio is presented by Sharpshooter Funding in association with PodcastArena.com and Gao Media.
Are you a small business looking to get over, but you don't have all the funds you need? Well, there's a solution. Check out sharpshooterfunding.com. At Sharpshooter Funding, they know that they have a solution to fit your specific needs. Their team has the experience and knowledge to find you the best product for your specific situation. Whether you're a first-time customer or a repeat business partner, their team will fulfill your needs. Give them a ring at 416-238-0252. That's 416-238-0252. Or send an email to dallas@sharpshooterfunding.com.
This is Bret Hart Radio. The best there is.
The best there was.
The best there ever will be.
Bret Hart Radio. Live from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Here are your hosts. WWE Hall of Famer Bret the Hitman Hart, his sons Blade and Dallas, and WrestleZone.com's Nick Houseman.
It's Bret Hart Radio.
Bret Hart Radio. Bret Hart Radio.
Hey, this is Bret the Hitman Hart, and this is another edition of Bret Hart Radio. You know, we're going to kick things off right away. We're going to go to my son Blade, who's here, and we're going to go to Nick, the Inflappable Nick Houseman.
Unflappable?
He's going to... Unflappable. Wow. Absolutely unshakable. Just
once you're solid as a stone,
solid as a rock in the mud.
Wow. So kind, thank you. Yes, this is the Sharpshooter Podcast, guys. That was a wonderful introduction from WWE Hall of Famer Bret the Hitman Hart there, and we have a lot to get into here today. Very excited. We're going to be welcoming on our good buddy Dylan Possel, better known to fans out there of WWE as Hornswoggle. Now, Swoggle. On the independents, and I know you guys actually kind of know Dylan a little bit already.
I know him well. I know him well. He's one of those old school kind of wrestlers. I've hung out with him quite a few times, and he's a lot of fun all the time, and he's a sincere good guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I've even had the pleasure of tilting back a couple MGDs and. In Arizona there at WrestleMania. So Dylan's the man. I'm excited to talk to him.
Awesome. Yes. Dylan will be here today. Also on this show, we're going to be talking all about the world of professional wrestling as we go sharpshooting with Bret Blade and Dallas here in just a couple minutes. But before we get going, we want to call out our sponsor, of course, here at the top of the show, Sharpshooter Funding. Sharpshooter Funding, of course, the place to go if you are in need of a small business loans and the bank is not making it easy for you. Blade, I know... This is this is your bread and butter here, Sharpshooter Funding. Anything nice you'd like to say about the company or our good buddy Paul Pitcher here today?
You know, we're still going. We're still trying to blow this thing up as fast as we can. Paul's doing really well in the States with First Down funding, so we're just, you know, trying to mirror that success over there.
Absolutely, guys. So go check out sharpshooterfunding.com. And while you're checking things out, go over to iTunes, subscribe to Bret Hart Radio. 5-star ratings and comments are always appreciated. You can find us on podcastarena.com. And before we get to a funny little story here, I do want to continue to remind people, if you want to help out, you want to help get the Hart Foundation into the WWE Hall of Fame, go over to HartFoundationForHallOfFame.com. And Bret, why you want to fill people in here real quickly about why this is important?
Well, we're trying to get as many people to sort of sign on with the idea that we get enough signatures that we can get the Hart Foundation into the Hall of Fame. I think it'd be a nice, nice gesture to have, not just Jim the Anvil, but there's a lot of all the rest of the members of the original Hart Foundation, are me and Jim. But aside from that, would be Owen, Davey, and Pillman, and they're, the fact that they're not represented in the Hall of Fame is kind of sad too. And it'd be nice to get enough people to write in that we can actually maybe, influence people to change that.
Absolutely. Well, guys, so again, HartFoundationForHallOfFame.com. That's the place to go sign the petition. Help get the Hart Foundation in the WWE Hall of Fame. But before we go sharpshooting with Bret Blade and Dallas here, before we started recording, there was something going on in the Hart household. And I don't know, you guys can tell the listeners out there what was going on just before we started recording here today.
Well, we've been having kind of a crisis here all day. You know, my cat named Rhonda.
After Rousey?
After Rhonda Rousey. I had two cats, one named Rhonda and one named Misha Tate. Misha, unfortunately, lost her last fight with a coyote, and we don't know where she went, but she's gone. So
she's in a better place.
And Rhonda's been holding her own, and she decided to bring in a squirrel about 10 o'clock this morning, and they fell through the window with the squirrel, big enough squirrel. It was like, she's not that big a cat. She's still just a kitten. But the squirrel got loose and is now barricaded himself somewhere within my stove. And we've tried for 4 or 5 hours to get him out. He just keeps squeaking in the wall. And now we've called in professionals.
I want to say really quick that my dad was almost control. He was almost like the elephant with the mouse. He was being really dainty. He's downplaying it.
I sat down. I had to think about what do you do when you have a mad, wild squirrel stuck in your wall of your stove. Like, what do you do at 10 in the morning?
My dad's wife, Stephanie, she had the fishing net out. She was hands-on. My dad was sitting there drinking his coffee, scratching his head.
Anyway, I realized that, what do? You call professionals.
Right.
Call Pest Control. Can-X Pest Control. My good friend Mike.
Club.
Now forging a battle against this monster.
Yeah, man. I mean, you spent some time, though. Were there tactics that you used that were unsuccessful in getting the squirrel out of the stove?
We went...
We got very angry. We gave him the fly swatter on the side of the wall.
We tried the old Canadian hockey stick method. That also was not a success.
And then we tried the cheap stuff, a cracker with peanut butter on, which he just scoffed at. Like, are you kidding?
Oh.
Yeah, I'm scared shitless in the wall here, and I'm going to stop and have a peanut butter fucking cracker.
No.
Man, thanks for the gesture, and you heart boys, I've heard everything I've heard about you guys is true. Yeah. But anyway, the mouse didn't, or the squirrel didn't fall for it, so like I said, we still got a crisis.
Crisis, yeah, and you're saying now that like one of the options here might be the sticky paper, right? And
that is a possibility. Another one is like some kind of where you don't want this thing to die in the wall.
It's a poisonous gas.
My whole kitchen up for a long time, but you have a dead squirrel in the wall and you can't get it out.
Sure. But you're like a bit of a humanitarian here. You would like ideally for the squirrel to live and be released.
I would like prefer to get him out of there. You know, the squirrels, I got no issue with, you know.
I think it's like the Great Escape. He's just in there throwing the baseball against the wall right now.
Man.
I did 3 years hard time in Hawaii, you know, where the occasional rodent run across your kitchen, mice and rats and lizards and all kinds of stuff. So you get the sticky trays.
Yeah.
But I was saying, like, when you've been in my shoes, and I know that the pest guy was talking about leaving the trays out, and I'm like, oh, that's kind of sad. When this thing goes off, it sneaks out at whenever it is, and he's finally come down from there.
Yeah.
He's stuck in the wall, so he's right at the very top of the stove counter, so he's way, way in there. And it's going to be tough to get him out of there.
Man.
I don't know what they're going to do.
Man,
But, you know, if he does go through the sticky tray, what do you do with the sticky tray?
Right.
They don't just die. They just lie on their like chest first and just lie there and or stuck there.
Struggle to death.
And the more they struggle, the more trapped they get. And it's awful.
Quicksand.
And squeaking. And I like squirrels myself. And it's like, so what do you do with you got this poor? You can't get them off. You can't peel them off or cut them out of it or, you know, soak it in water and they come out of it. Or, you know, all you can do is try to come up with humane ways or, you know.
I'm going to laugh if PETA comes at you for this
kill,
one.
A rodent on a sticky tray, and you know, one thought was you take it and you stick it in the toilet and hold it under the water till he drowns, and that sounds pretty morbid. Yeah, or you get a small steak knife or something like that, and you try to cut his head off while he's on there, and with a steak fork, you hold his steak right on his knife or fork right on his skull and saw his head off Isis style, you know.
Yeah.
Or of course you can just set them on fire is another option.
Altitude
or
dispose of the squirrel.
Yeah. Scissors would work. I don't know. You could try to cut them up.
Yeah.
But it's like, what do you really do? I mean, they don't explain that on the box, like what to do with it once you catch it. And, you know, my old trick in Hawaii, because I didn't know what the heck to do with this mouse, and I feel sorry for any little animal, but so I would just take them, put them in the plastic bag, and then I would tie the bag in a knot. So that gave them about 10 minutes of breathing time. And
that's awful.
Gave him a chance.
This is terrible.
That gives him a chance to, you know, to make all his
say his prayers and need his life in
order, put all his affairs in order, and get ready to meet his maker. You know, it's like, what else can I do? I'm not gonna get a hammer.
iPhone in the
when
back.
You got a mouse on one of those trays, or a squirrel especially, was poor sweet little squirrel.
Yeah.
And you got to bash its skull in with a hammer. It's not very, it's not good for the soul.
Yeah.
Makes it hard.
Squirrels out there just trying to get a nut.
Doing the show kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, there's a good chance here, and I know we got to cut to the sharpshooter here in a second, but I've had friends over the years that have had pet squirrels. So maybe best case scenario, like, Rhonda, the squirrel, they harmonize. You guys hit it off. The squirrel could, you know, maybe stick around.
I wish they could work something out, but I don't think right now that's an option. It's kind of off the table right now. The poor cat, she's stuck in the garage. We threw her in the garage, and she doesn't know what to do. She's stuck in there with. But we got to keep them apart because this cat just scares them out, the squirrel more. And they're sure. Both squeaking, crying, and it's like. It's a sad state of affairs upstairs, and you're lucky. We're lucky you're down here doing the show.
Wow.
To be continued. Godspeed up there for pest control, Mike.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, next week I guess we will get to find the resolution for the squirrel. Unless the squirrel is still there a week later, then this could be a three-part series. You know.
Yeah, or we may know an outcome while the show is on.
Man, and
that's what we're hoping. Is there some kind of good news that he surrendered? He's marches himself right out the front door and
wow,
bids wow. us adieu.
Wow, what a show we've had already. Still to come, you're going to get part one of our interview with Dylan Possel, Hornswoggle. And right now, guys, it's time to drop everything because we're going sharpshooting with Brett Bladen Dallas.
It's time to go sharpshooting. Sharpshooting. News and notes from professional wrestling and beyond. It's sharpshooting. With Bret Hart, presented by Sharpshooter Funding.
All right, guys, it's that time of the show where we go sharpshooting with Brett Bladen Dallas. And this week, we are taking a look at some upcoming speculation going into the WWE draft. Now, this past Monday night on Raw, Dean Ambrose was only referred to as the WWE champion. It also said that on his graphic, WWE champion, leading many to speculate that we could be having two world champions once the draft is split. One world champion, one world heavyweight champion. Brett, I was just kind of wondering what you thought of the idea of having two world champions. Are you a fan of this?
I'm not opposed to it. You know, I sometimes feel like they're two distinct different brands, and maybe that's what they're trying to do. Seems like the Raw is much more promo sort of oriented, with a lot of promo stuff and a lot of I don't know. I find that the other show, SmackDown, sort of is a little less contrived, a little less on the promos and more on the work, and Raw's more on the promos and less on the wrestling. So, I mean, they're distinctly different. I sort of think eventually it always comes down to like a match of the two champions fighting each other, and then there's a unified, it's all about how interesting they want to make it. You know, it could be really interesting. And also at the same time, I like one champion. I like one distinct era. Like, you know, like if you look at the reign of champions going down way back to Buddy Rogers and all that, it's like, you know, every single guy that was champion should mean something, you know? When I think of WCW and how they had that actor guy end up being the champion, the guy that lost to
David Arquette.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't think there. How can you have a history with a David Arquette being the champion? Nothing anything against him. He just did what he was asked to do and all that. But and he was a famous enough guy to be, you know, in the entertainment of wrestling and all that. But I'm not talking about him in a negative way. But it does no justice to the title. And so I like, you know, when I look at the WWF or WWE history and you go all the way through from the beginning, it's going from Buddy Rogers to Bruno to this guy to that guy. It's nice. And, you know, I don't want to see that sort of discontinued where suddenly it's like it's a fork in the road. You got two different champions now. And I don't know, but there it's if it's interesting, they got enough really interesting kind of characters. You know, everybody's very similar in size and height and sort of ring style. And like if you look at Dean Ambrose and the style of wrestling he has, I know he's a bit hardcore kind of guy, but you look at him and you look at Seth Rollins and you look at, you know, all of them. They're all about the same size. They're all a good, healthy sort of 230-pound or 220-pound, pretty fit kind of men that all kind of got different gimmicks. And this, you look at Cena and you look at Kevin Owens and you start looking at all the talent they got. There's enough guys that you could have two whole federations, you know. So I think it's certainly doable. It's how interesting they can make it. Knowing Vince, he'll make it pretty interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, Blake Dallas, are you guys fans of the two champion system or do you prefer a single champ?
For the two brands, I think you need it, really. But
yeah, I mean, do you do two women's champions then? Like one for each brand, two sets of tag titles? Does it have to be up and down?
I think you would have to, but it's a question, do they have enough talent for it? I actually don't like the brand splits. It is what it is.
You want to have
the
Raw
is never going to be overpowered by SmackDown as hard as they try.
I think you want to have one girl champion, and I think you want to have one tag team champion.
Yeah. Well, last but not least here, as we wrap up the sharpshooting segment, because we have a long, wonderful Hornswoggle or Dylan Postle interview to give you guys here in just a moment. But one thing that you know caught my attention as I was kind of sifting through the news from the past week was last night. We saw the Social Outcasts on Raw. They were making. Did you guys get to watch Raw last night? First of all,
yeah, I watched it.
Did you see? What did you think of the? You know, they're not soft. They're hard. Who's the hardest? Which one of you guys is a bunch of dick jokes? I guess what I'm asking.
Yeah, Enzo and Cass. I like their gimmick. I like
didn't
everything they're
the
doing.
Question.
Yeah, like
the two tag teams. Like who is?
Oh, the Social Outcast. Yeah, their intro is dumb. It looks.
Yeah,
it didn't fit in with anything.
For Axel, that's Henning's.
Bo Dallas.
Oh, yeah. I wish they would do so much more with.
Yeah, that's a shitty gimmick for good
Axel,
records, I think.
You know, or Kurt's kid.
That's exactly.
It's just such a shame.
Yeah, that's where I was going. He released a vignette after Raw last night. It's a 20-second little vignette for himself that I think he made himself, really pushing the idea that he should be a character that is rooted in his father's legacy. So you're going exactly where I was going here. What's the deal with Curtis Axel? Why choose to push him like this? Why not make him the son of Mr. Perfect?
I've never understood it from the beginning. Even the name McGillicuddy or whatever, what that gimmick was. It's like, it just seems almost like impossible odds to turn that into any kind of successful storyline. It's like, you know, what do you do with that? You know, I don't know. It never made a lot of sense to me. And I think that he's a really a wasted talent. I think he's a real talent. He's every bit, I think the athlete and the performer that his dad was.
Yeah.
And I just always felt that he was a little bit like Cody Rhodes, where it's like, they never quite, gave the right things to,
shit, you could
to
have
make
put
him the
Cody
star that he was.
Wade Barrett, you could have put him with anybody. I think the gimmick they have now is just it's
a lot of times they seem to kill off second generation wrestlers. I mean, sometimes it might be because
trying to push Van
Damme, you know, that they have hard feelings towards what their dad did. Not that I know of anything that they would begrudge Kurt for, but it's Bulldog was a guy that I know made a lot of enemies in the business, maybe especially when he had drug problems. And
I think it's because they want to own your character, though. I don't think it's really a grudge on anybody.
I don't know. Sometimes the fact that they never used him with any kind of real flair. It's like, you know, I could see in the beginning that maybe what do you do with him? Like, how do you turn a guy, give him that experience and get him that? Like, look at Randy Orton. You know, they've done great things for him. Yeah, but he's got a real name. He's got his dad's legacy. He's you know, to give him the same opportunity that Randy's got would be would be really nice. You know, he would have a lot more momentum. More people would be talking about him today if you called him Mr. Perfect 2 or something like that. But, you know, I'll never understand it. How they used him and how they brought him in the first place, it seems so, you know, it's never really going to amount to very much, no matter what, whoever you are as a wrestler, if they give you a gimmick like that and stick you to that. You know, even, you know, Heath Slater, there's another guy that's a real talent and a really good wrestler and a hard worker. And, you know, they always come up with these lame storylines and he's always in them. And it's a shame because he's a real workhorse out there.
Yeah. Can you imagine? You're coming to the ring right now. Blade and Dallas McGillicuddy, right? And they totally get rid of the heart.
I feel like there's like an era there, like a couple of years back. Like, you know, that's why Harry didn't get his own name. I think that's why they changed Natty's name. Like they try to, you know, that's why Bo Rotundo is not like, you know, doesn't have his real name. I feel like it's because they don't want you to have your own character. They don't want you to profit off your own name after you leave there. Yeah. Like I don't understand now, like, you know, Flair's daughter gets your name. Like,
they're not making enough money. So they want to own your name and everything that you ever do. And it's, I don't know. I think when you're dad's, when you got a reputation or a history like Curtis Axel's got with his dad and that whole backstory, it's like, why wouldn't you want to play on that? Or why wouldn't you want to play up on the story of, you know, Bulldog's kid being Bulldog's kid? And
yeah, if they tried to change my name to Blake Hunt or something, I'd be fucking pissed, to be honest.
Blade Hunter. Yeah, you're Triple H's son. In the WWE.
Blake Hunt. This is, you know, Blake Hunt, 190 pounds, scrawny.
All right, guys. Well, with that, we are going to move away from the sharpshooting with Bret Hart segment. It is time right now to welcome our guest to the show. This is part one. Part two is going to be released this Friday in the Hart Family Vault. Here he is, former WWE superstar Hornswoggle, Dylan Possel.
Subscribe to Bret Hart Radio on iTunes. Now, back to the show. Here's Bret Hart.
I got one of my good friends and a special guest on today, my good friend Dylan Possel. Dylan, good to have you on the show.
Brett, it's for you calling me a good friend of yours is a complete honor. I appreciate that very much, as we always have been real good friends. And so to be on the podcast is always awesome.
We've had a few good memories down the road when I was in WWE. I can remember, you know, partying with you a little bit in England and some of those trips that we were on. But it was always interesting talking to you. And where are you now? Where's home? What state?
Home is Oshkosh, Wisconsin. I grew up here, born and raised, and I'll never leave. I love it here too much.
Yeah, you know, I always liked Wisconsin. I loved Wisconsin. I was actually a big fan. One of my favorite big cities was Milwaukee. We always had great fans in Milwaukee and even Green Bay. They were always really good fans. I in particular Madison, Wisconsin was the most fun place for me. It was always a fun town to be in. It's a really good college town, and it was always a great time. A lot of good bars with music and a lot of good looking girls everywhere. I used to love going there.
Sober in Madison is quite the feat. It's quite the drinking town.
I don't know that I can say that I ever succeeded at that.
I actually got arrested in Madison, but for what it's worth, I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. My beer bottle fell on the sidewalk during Halloween, and they were like, "You have weapons and intent to start a riot." And I was like, "No, I don't." But
I would love to go there for Halloween, but I don't know if I'd make it out alive.
I barely did. It's quite a.
am I right to say, or am I? You recall a place that was called the Black Bear Bar or the Black Bear Den or something like that, or
I know of it. I haven't frequented it yet.
I just remember it. It was always fun going hanging out in that town. It was always a good town to go out after the show for sure.
Yeah, I've frequented quite a few of the establishments in the Wisconsin area. So, and it always feels like home.
So now you're not longer in WWE, right?
Nope. I got released. I believe it was May 10th. Could be wrong on the date, but it's, I'm busier. I'm busier than I have been in the last year and a half. That's for sure. I've been gone every weekend. It's been crazy, but it's been so much fun.
So is that a bit of weight off your back in some ways without all the commitment and travel? And I know that it's got to wear you down.
It's, you know, I wasn't on the road the last year. But the thing is now if I want to be home for something, I can make sure of it. I can make sure no matter what, I'm going to be there for my son's first day of school every year, or his karate meets, or this, that, and the other thing. Or if I just want a weekend off, I can say, you know what, I'm going to make sure I have this weekend off. I can plan a vacation, and I can just do it. And that's kind of the cool thing for me, where if I want to work a weekend, I can work that weekend. If I don't, I can stay home that weekend. But you got to also, the hardest part is the grind, is realizing, you know, that you have to pound the pavement, and you have to, if you're not earning the money, it's not going to come in. So you have to still, you have to be a little bit of a hustler, more than you do with WWE at times, because with WWE, the check's coming no matter what, essentially, as long as you're under contract. But now it's, you're pounding pavement and you're making your own money.
So now do you get booked out for wrestling shows, or more like comic conventions, or more?
I've done signings, random signings at like a pizza party in New York 2 weeks ago. That was unreal, but it was so much fun. It was easy, but I've been wrestling every weekend, which is a ton of fun. It's brought my passion back for the business.
Because you were like a full on wrestler with a career and all that before you did the gimmick with WWE, right?
Yeah, I was 19 when I got hired, but for 2 years I was indie wrestling. And fully, I hated being a midget wrestler. I hated it, absolutely hated it, because it wasn't me. I saw myself as a small athlete, not a midget wrestler. So it was always, I hated doing the ha-ha stuff. So when I got hired and I had to do the ha-ha stuff, it was like, oh man, well, I can't bitch too much because this is my dream job and it's what they hired me to do. But yeah, I was, but it's cool to now get back to my roots of wrestling every weekend. But then you realize just how out of shape you've gotten the last year and a half. And so the in-ring stuff kicks your ass for a little bit for the first couple months.
Well, I've been a guy that like all my life was around midget wrestlers and had a lot to do with and hung out with a lot of midget wrestlers all growing up, and became very familiar with them and very comfortable, mm-hmm. and had a lot of long conversations. And I know that it's funny how the midget wrestling industry is sort of a lot like the big time wrestling, but it's on a totally different level. I mean, it's a totally different thing, but they have the same pride in having a good match. There's guys that work really hard. There's guys that are legit tough guys that and there's some that are great workers. It's just like the pro ranks. It's all very similar in the sense that, I know growing up that Skylar Lowe, for example, and Little Beaver and all those guys were considered the best in the world. They were the best midget wrestlers that took it up a notch higher than anyone ever took it, kind of thing. And then, you know, the Lord Littlebrook started the wrestling or hiring a lot of midget wrestlers out of, was it Kansas City, I think. But, I know there were certain wrestlers that took a lot of pride in their work. I remember, I don't know if you're familiar with a lot of the old names, like Irish
I know the
Jack.
Names. I always say I never looked up their stuff because I was always too, I don't know. I hate it. Like I said, I hated being a midget wrestler. So I never watched any footage, but I was too enamored with Attitude Era and the cruiserweights of WCW and what was happening on Raw to go back and look and watch old stuff.
Well, I know, like Little Tokyo was a Japanese wrestler, but he was a tough little guy, and very like a hard. He was just like all the other Japanese wrestlers. Yeah. He was a really interesting character that I hung out with him lots of times. And Cowboy Lang was another guy that was from Red Deer, Alberta.
And I've always heard about Cowboy Lang and how he could put some back some booze back in his day too. So I think
all of them good. All of them, and they were all ladies' men. They were always they liked the big gals. A lot of them did anyway. And there was, I remember Cowboy Lang was kind of like the midget version of Jack Briscoe. He was a real serious little wrestler that liked to do.
Okay.
He was actually, he was a really good worker, like a really smooth, he could do everything. He wanted to wrestle.
We lost you for a second, Brett. You're back. You're good to go. Sorry. We don't.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm just saying, like with Cowboy Lang, he was a guy that he wanted to be a real wrestler. He didn't want to be a cartoon or, you know, go into all the slapstick kind of stuff that midgets, yeah, a lot of midgets never, do.
But back then, they never wrestled normal size guys, really, did they?
No, they didn't wrestle normal size guys. No. Okay. But
I didn't think so.
I don't remember that. They were sometimes mixed tags where one big guy against a little. Sometimes the big guy would do something to hurt the little guy to pin the end of the match or something, pull his foot when he's hitting the ropes. Or,
yep.
But generally, they you didn't touch a little guy. It was too considered too too rough, I think, because most of the time people knew fans that came to watch the midgets most of the time were little kids, and that was kind of what they were. They were kind of the portrayed as slapstick or this is fun. It's more of a comedy act and stuff like that. But in saying that, when it was a comedy act, there was always a thread, just like there is in pro wrestling, of truth and reality of certain guys were tough guys and certain guys weren't, and certain guys pride themselves on their work. Some guys were, you know, they were just like the pros. They were all certain styles and certain things, but I know they all had this sort of inner respect for each other, you know.
I'll say Torito.
And I remember Cowboy Lang. I mean, he was.
Yep.
I was going to say Cowboy Lang. He was a real pro, and I always had a lot of respect for him. I know that he wanted to go out there and just wrestle like a pro wrestler and do all the big moves because he could do them all.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, no, no. We need you to go out and do you know, something where you bite the referee on the butt, or you know, they push you back. It was always comedy and.
Yep.
You know, I understood. I remember him talking to me. He goes, I just want to do the, what you guys are doing. You know, I just want to be a real wrestler. I don't want to be a cartoon. And I had a lot of empathy for him. I was going, you know, I respect that. This guy, because he's that good. He's a good enough athlete. And he's he just wants to be a real wrestler. And I could see where there's just like pro wrestling and amateur wrestling, sort of like there's two completely different avenues. And but Some midget wrestlers were so good at the comedy stuff and telling a funny story around that. And you know, there was some great, as a kid growing up, I loved the midget wrestling. I loved them. I used to love wait for them to come to town, and when they did come to town, I always try to hang out with them and sit with them. You know, which I think they found kind of annoying. But
did your dad bring a lot in ever or no?
All the time. Every year, at least maybe once or twice a year, he'd bring them in for like sometimes 5-6 weeks, you know.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. They were a big draw up here. That for one thing, you know, and same with the girl wrestlers. They would bring the girls in usually once or twice a year, especially during the Stampede, for example, my dad's big show. They always had the girl wrestlers, the midget wrestlers. They'd even have a Bear and Andre the Giant and the McGuire twins all on the same card if they could. It was kind of built as to be a sort of a extravaganza kind of thing.
Yeah.
But
everything I knew in the kitchen sink.
I knew from talking to the wrestlers, the midget wrestlers, there was always all different kind of styles and different groups that were clustered. Some worked for Little Brook out of Kansas City or Missouri or whatever it was. St. Joe, I think, is where he lived.
Really?
And then there was other midgets out of Hawaii and stuff like that. Coconut Willie was one of the best midget wrestlers I ever saw. He was a Hawaiian midget, and he could dive off. He could do everything Snuka could do, maybe better than Snuka. He was a real talent too, but and cute as a button. I mean, he was the cutest little Hawaiian guy you could ever see. He had the biggest smile. And talk about girls. He had girls all the time, that little Coconut Willie, but I remember so many of them anyway. Even there used to be a wrestling company called the BloodyMidgets.com. You remember them?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
I don't know if they're still around, but I remember going to Australia with them, and they were a great bunch of guys. And I really always enjoyed, as when I do, even when I hung out with you, I can remember it always was a good vibe and a good personal experience for me to always hang out. And I found that midgets were always happy, always had a good sense of humor, and always like having fun. You know, that they
you can't take yourself too seriously. I learned that. And, I learned at an early age. The minute you start taking yourself too seriously, you'll never gain a lot of friends in this world, especially in this business.
Yeah, I think it's got to be a tough thing to deal with all the time. You know, especially when people don't know how to react or see where it can be awkward. You know, but I think the rest of the business, for the most part, has been very open arms with the the little people and the midgets and wrestling.
Very, very much, especially like you look at Torito, who is absolutely amazing as a worker, but then as a midget worker, he's insane. The stuff he does is absolutely incredible, the stuff Torito can do. And I've always said that. When he got hired and I was under contract, I was like, yep, hand me my walking papers now. Because once he's around, there's nothing I can do compared to him. But that's why it was so much fun working with him too, is that I learned so much about working from him, and then I could actually try to wrestle a little bit and show I could possibly do some stuff that that the company didn't know. So like wrestling business and like WWE, and it's always a roller coaster of what they want to do at the time, you know, and that's what they've always done with the midgets too. Are they going to have them wrestle? Are they going to have them do ha-ha? It's always a roller coaster of what they want, but they've always given them always an opportunity.
What was that? Were you a little kid when you saw Bundy, Big Splash? Who was it?
It was to Little Beaver, I want to say, or Haiti Kid, one of the two.
Yeah,
but that was the year I was born, actually. I've obviously seen it, but yeah, that was the year I was born.
How would something like that be perceived? Would you kind of like the fact that he did that, or would you not like it, but like enjoy the entertainment of it, or would you that's over the line?
I think when I was a kid, that's too strong. I love it now. I love it now. It's the man. There's no better way to get heat than a 400-pound guy splashing a midget. Let's be honest here. I mean. So I love it now, but as a kid, I think I would have even been like, as any kid would be, of, oh, that's not right. You know, giving him the heel reaction that he was supposed to get. I just don't think wrestling business, you know, sometimes people take it too damn seriously at times. It's for entertainment purposes, and yeah, it's supposed to be taken seriously at times, but how can you take a 400-pound guy and splashing a midget, how can you take that seriously? Like, oh man, this is terrible for people to see. It's ridiculous to me.
I always thought, I mean, maybe I'm wrong and you don't have to say either way, but it's like, I always thought it was kind of cool that Vince had you around.
I loved it.
It was like, I always liked the fact that there was midgets or little people in wrestling. Mm-hmm. I always liked it. I always got along with them. I was always happy to sort of have them on my card or be around them. I mean, all through my life, all through my career. And then suddenly they're not around anymore. And
it's easy for kids to like midget wrestlers because they think either that they're the same age as them or that they're just kids too or just that they're fun-loving characters. So for them to be involved in wrestling, it's always going to have that kid-friendly fan base. And that's what I think had was the reason for my longevity is my kid fan base.
I've always said that Vince is probably the biggest, deep down, is the biggest wrestling fan there ever was. That's why he's as passionate as he is. But I've always liked that he hired midgets and used them and kept them in storylines and all the stuff that he did with you. I always enjoyed it. I always was glad it was on the show. It was a good trade off from something more serious they were doing. I always was a nod back to the old days with Skylo Lo, Little Beaver. It was just like nice that they were on the cards and that they used you. you know, I'm glad that you had a reasonably long career in WWE. You know, it's commendable.
It's pretty insane when you think about how long I was with the company. Almost 10 years yeah. when I was told that I was going to be there maybe 3 months.
So it's yeah, always, I think it, it's always pretty crazy I'm that glad I, they gave you all that.
It's, yeah,
I just wish I don't mind saying I've missed you on the show. I missed the roles that you had, and I hope that maybe maybe somehow you'll circle back and end up back there for another storyline or a few storylines.
As we always know,
you had a great character, and
yeah,
and you were a lot of fun to watch on TV, and you were a nice sidebar to everything else they had going.
I appreciate that more than you know.
I was just going to say, one thing I wanted to throw out there is, you know, one thing I know fans are going to ask about is you guys throw around the term midget. And I know you've yep. corrected yourself a couple times going back and forth, Brett, saying midget or little people wrestlers. I know it's something people are going to want me to ask you guys to talk about is, you know, that term, because on the outside looking in, it's something, you know, kind of frowned upon.
I always said it makes me money. That word makes me money because you put dwarf wrestling or little person wrestling on a poster, people don't know what it is. You put midget wrestling on a poster, people know right away what it is.
Yeah, I don't know. That's how I've been termed it since I was born. So it's a little, not that that makes it a right, but I think we talked about it a few weeks ago. We were talking about midget wrestlers, and it came up with it as to whether it was degrading or an insult. And I thought, I'm glad you brought it up, because I don't want to say, I would never want to say anything, but that's. I wouldn't say anything that's ever offensive to a little person or a no. midget wrestler, but at the same time, that's what it's called, and that's how I've always known
exactly
it to be
what
called.
It's called. And
I never had anybody ever object to it.
I've
heard midget wrestlers refer to it as midget wrestling or in the business and that kind of stuff. So
that's what it's always been.
It's a good question to know if it is offensive, because if it is, I'll be more careful about it.
No, again, that's if you take yourself too seriously, and you always if you get upset about someone using that term, you take yourself too seriously. You're a midget. You wrestle. That's what you do.
Yeah, I that's what I think. I made that argument, and just because I've always got along so well with guys in the business that I didn't feel that it was any kind of an. If it was ever said, which it was plenty of times, it was never said with any kind of malice. It was always said with proper intentions. Just the same way in wrestling. Not that it makes it right, but a lot of times the Japanese wrestlers were always referred to as the Japs. They were always referred to as Japs. So even Japanese wrestlers refer to themselves as Japs, and it's not offensive in wrestling. It's not offensive. Whereas I say, if you called somebody a Jap on the street corner, that might be offensive. But in wrestling, in a lot of ways, that's why I love the most about wrestling, is that I never saw a lot of racial tensions ever in the dressing room between black wrestlers. Or I never the wrestlers all learn that you got to trust each other and you got to work with each other. So you can't. There's no room for that kind of stuff. And even. Gay wrestlers. I knew lots of gay wrestlers through my career. People like Pat Patterson, and it was just accepted, and they were never bothered or bullied or treated less for. In a lot of ways, pro wrestling was years and years ahead of society on.
Actually a really good point. You're going in front of millions of people in your underwear. Every week or every night, how thick a skin do you have just to do that? So it's not like you should be offended by someone giving you a little grief. That's again, like you said, you work with. So if that's going to offend you, but yet you're going to do some of the storylines they have you do, or that stuff. I think you got to check yourself at the door there.
I agree. I think that. It takes just enough to go out there to do it the first time.
Yeah.
And to make it convincing, to actually try to sort of show everyone that you're a professional in some regard, that what you're doing is a professional occupation,
exactly.
I think you, you got to learn to take a lot of, you know, what the audience gives you. And I don't know. I know that both my boys, they both had a lot of trouble putting on wrestling gear and pulling off the shirts and then wearing
wearing the old grape smugglers.
They couldn't wear. They were, I remember Dal when he's talking about getting into wrestling. He's like, he goes, I'm not going to wear wrestling trunks or tights. You know? I'm going to wear shorts and a tank top. And I'm going, you can't wear that. You got to wear knee pads and get a, you know,
well, you know, 1980 maybe that.
Yeah, the pink leotard was cool.
You can get away with the cargo shorts.
I remember the first time I walked out to the ring. It was in Saskatoon, which didn't really matter because it was nobody there. Less than 100 people in Saskatoon. But I would go the next day to Regina for my second match of my career, and it would be like, you know, really good house, packed little arena, maybe about 1,000, 1,500 people watching. And, you know, I'd walk out in my trunks and my boots and white skin, no jacket, no gear. And I get the hell booed out of me, and I'd feel like shit. I'd just stand in the corner and go, what am I doing here? And I think, thank God this isn't in my hometown.
That's in front of 100 people in Saskatoon? No. How'd you doing it now in front of 300 people with cell phones, YouTube? No, man. Times have changed, bro.
You're in Cali. That was when you were a cowboy, Bret Hart?
No, that was just Bret Hart, period. Cowboy was even a long ways off. But I can remember there was people I knew that girls and stuff that were like my age that knew me as a referee, because I was a referee all before. And when I walk out, they all would laugh like it was the funniest thing to see me walk out and get in the ring, pretend I was a pro wrestler. And I can remember that. That's what bothered me the most, was that they didn't really buy it at first. And that was the hardest part, you know.
Yeah.
I was to go and get up and pull my boots on a week later and do it again and walk out and get that, you know, that aha laugh that guy does on Simpsons, that kid.
Nelson. Yep.
Nelson. It was like that. It was the exact same thing. Then I would walk out and I'd have all these girls do that same aha thing. And I remember walking all the way past. But that's how you get a tough skin. That's how you, and you start learning and you start getting better and you start believing in yourself and you start, you know, and a few year or two later, it's who's doing the aha. I'm doing the aha to them kind of
exactly
thing.
Exactly.
You gotta.
Oh, Brett, we lost you for a moment there. Brett, you're still there, Dylan, right?
Yep.
Can you hear me now?
You're back.
Both my boys, they chickened out, had no guts. They were gutless when it came to going out to the ring.
We
they
could still always take him
boots on. And they couldn't find, like, Dad, I can't do it.
We're gonna rough him up after the show.
Yeah, today. He's gonna get a sharpshooter after the
Dad,
shooter.
I can't. You know, it's like what, anyway, they both.
Here's a question I had. What was the reason or what caused the initial wearing of pink and black? There's an odd question that I don't know if you've ever got. You've probably gotten it by now.
Well, the pink came pretty much by fluke. We were trying to, in those days, we wore gear with sort of an alternate stripe. You know, we wore light blue with a black stripe, and then we had black with a light blue stripe. We had a couple of different sets of gear with stripes down the side. And in the end, we had every color that we could think of, except for green, which I never for some reason liked, or orange or anything like that. But I remember the lady that used to make our gear. She was a girl named Judy over at K&H Wrestling Wear in Ohio. Mm-hmm. Every wrestler that ever started back in the 70s or 80s would know Judy from K&H. But anyway, she called. When I talked to her about getting some wrestling gear for the Saturday night main event, she goes, I got a really nice hot pink. And I can remember covering the phone up and asking Neidhart if he wanted hot pink. And he goes, nah, I'm not going to wear hot pink. Are you kidding me? And it was like, so I told her, I said, we'll call back in a couple of weeks. We'll have to think about what we could use for a color or another one maybe. And so I called her another month later or so, because the Saturday night main event was getting closer, because I think I had a couple of months notice on it. But anyway, I called her again and our gear was falling apart. And we had to order some new gear, and she ran the pink by me again. And I said, nah, I don't think so. And I asked Neidhart again if he wanted to get the pink tight or pink stripe down the side. And he goes, let's go for it. And it was kind of more of a laugh. I kind of caught Jim at one of those moments where he thought it would be funny to have pink, a pink stripe down the side. And you know, whereas a month before he was very definitive that he did not want it. And that's how Jim was, kind of fickle, where he one day he just changed his mind. But so we went with the pink. It looked really good. I liked the black with the pink stripe. I thought it looked really cool. And then we made the big decision to go with the pink tights and the black stripe. And that took some nerve. We were bright, hot pink, and we looked like bubblegum when we walked in. And everybody, yep. We certainly got everyone's attention. And that was the story. The true story about it is that at the Saturday Night Main Event, when we were at catering, Vince came in with Dick Ebersol, and he just about did a backflip. And just he came over to me, and goes, he walked around me about three times, and he told me, he said, "Don't move." Oh, just no, walking around me, circling around me, and can you hear me?
Yeah, we lost you for a second. You can go back to what Vince said to you. I'm fascinated. So,
all right, so Vince would circle around me, and he said, he goes, "That is what you guys have been missing. That's what you guys haven't had since you got here. You can work, and you can do this, and you can do that, but you've been missing. You never had any color." He goes, "Wow. From now on, don't ever change that color, and don't ever change the. I want you to wear those all the time." So we went with the pink tights after that, and the pink and black. And that's where it all started, mostly. And it was good. It actually, you know, back then it was a kind of a cool look. Nobody else had pink and black.
Yeah.
And we were such an odd combination. If you really look at Night Art with the flat top and the goat beard and all that, it was, and the way he was built like a tank. Jim was an odd looking, almost like a Bugs Bunny character. Didn't he look like a mad professor, one of those Bugs Bunny cartoons? Combined with me and the sunglasses and the sort of the more sex appealing kind of guy and Jimmy Hart, and it was kind of an interesting combination. And I think, you know, sometimes when you mix certain wrestlers together or certain tag team especially, but certain ideas that are like how a character evolves and how, say, someone like CM Punk, you know, got to where he did. Got at the end, and you know, a lot of guys would have looked at him and said, "He's not big enough, he's not this, he's not that." But in the end, whatever it is he had was all the right mix of all the ingredients to make a great, great wrestler. And same with me and Anvil. I think that we had an interesting combination as a team. We had different, we could work with the big guys because Night Art was pretty big. Mm-hmm. So we could work with Demolition, we could work with the Legion of Doom, we could work with the Barbarian and Warlord. We could, you know, it was pretty easy for us to work with the big giants, including Earthquake, including Andre, Dino Bravo. There's lots of teams that had big, big guys, Elmer and Hillbilly Jim. And then there was the guys like the Killer Bees, the Rougeos, the Bulldogs, the smaller guys, the fast-paced, quick sort of action-packed kind of wrestlers like the Rockers and stuff. And it's like, that's where I step in, and Jim could kind of come down a notch and work with those guys, and I could come up a notch and work with the big powerhouses that were working in those days. So we were a really well-balanced team. You know, we used to have that motto about being a cross between a Porsche and a tank, but it was true. We kind of brought all that out. We had lots of moves in our arsenal. Like, we could come up with different moves, including our finish, which was, you know, a true teamwork finish, you know, which is hard to find in pro wrestling.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. This has been another episode of the Sharpshooter Podcast on Bret Hart Radio. Be sure to tune back in this Friday for a brand new episode of Hart Family Vault, where you're going to get part two of our interview with Hornswoggle. You're also going to get the 4 out of 10 and 10 out of 10 for the week, as well as the hashtag Ask the Hitman segment. Be sure to go over to iTunes, subscribe to Bret Hart Radio. It's absolutely free. 5-star ratings and comments are absolutely appreciated, and we will see you guys on Friday.
Bret Hart Radio is a TJ DeSantis production. In association with Nick Houseman and Sharpshooter Funding, Bret Hart Radio. Its content is intended for private use only.